You're listening to Part 4 of Chapter 9, The Frontal Lobe of the Brain, from the book Depression, The Way Out, by Dr. Neil Nedley. Lessons from Carbohydrates. Even everyday foods that are commonly eaten can have an impact on either enhancing or diminishing frontal lobe activity. Other parts of the body can use fat, protein, or carbohydrates for energy, but not the brain. The brain uses glucose, a simple carbohydrate, almost exclusively as its source of energy. Apparently, as a result of the brain's very rapid metabolism, it is dependent on minute-to-minute supplies of this simple carbohydrate. This becomes easier to appreciate when you understand that the brain has a metabolic rate of 7.5 times greater than the average body tissue. Although it makes up only 2% of our body's mass, the brain accounts for 15% of our total metabolism. The brain does not have much room to store nutrients. Space is extremely limited by the hard shell of the skull. Only a 2-minute supply of glucose is available to the brain cells, and this in the form of glycogen, the storage form of sugar. For peak performance, the frontal lobe requires blood with a steady and adequate glucose level. Years ago, when scientists first discovered that the brain functions best with carbohydrate fuel, some people began referring to candy bars as brain food. Eventually, we learned that for sustained performance, refined sugar was not brain food at all. It has been stated that large amounts of sugar in the diet have been demonstrated to impair frontal lobe function in school-age children. This implied that reduced amounts of refined sugar in the diet strengthen the activity of the frontal lobe. Research has verified the truth of this statement. Children seem to be particularly susceptible to decreased thinking and intellectual function as a result of sugar consumption. Even academically well-prepared children can get poorer grades on their tests if they choose the wrong food for their brains. One study of over 45-year-old boys is particularly revealing. Boys with little sugar in their diet had superior attention spans and more accurate responses than their high-sugar-consuming peers. The difference could not be explained by IQ or the parent's social or educational status. When tested, the boys on a low refined sugar diet performed the equivalent of one whole letter grade higher in school. This provocative study suggests that a better diet may help transform a B student into an A-level scholar. Why does a high sugar diet impair brain function? If sugar is a carbohydrate and carbohydrate is the frontal lobe's preferred fuel, then how does a high sugar diet impair brain function? Our bodies were created to eat foods such as fruits and grains in a natural, unrefined state. These foods help keep our blood sugar at a fairly constant level. However, when refined sugary foods enter the digestive system, the blood sugar rises dramatically, and the body reacts as if it was just exposed to a great volume of natural food. In response, the pancreas produces a large amount of insulin. However, the rapid rise in blood sugar is deceptive. Unlike natural plant foods, foods rich in refined sugar are quickly absorbed, and the rapid rise in blood sugar is quickly over. With insulin still present, and no more sugar coming in via the digestive tract, the blood sugar level is driven down. It is not unusual for the blood sugar to drop well below where it was before the sugary food was eaten. When blood sugar levels fall low enough, frontal lobe function suffers due to inadequate fuel supplies. To make matters worse, the more common response to hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, is to eat yet another sugary snack. Although this will drive the blood sugar up quickly again, research demonstrates that it takes the brain another 45 to 75 minutes to regain normal intellectual function after the blood sugar returns to normal. In proof positive, I refer to a classic study that lends some support to the preceding explanation. Dr. Haber and colleagues explain the effects of eating apples in each of the three different physical forms, as whole apples, as applesauce, and as apple juice. Even though the same number of calories was consumed from each preparation, eating whole apples kept blood sugar steadier than drinking apple juice or using applesauce alone. Within 60 minutes, the apple juice caused a drop in blood sugar. Blood sugars following whole apple consumption were similar to those before it was consumed. Blood sugar changes after the applesauce fell in a range between the juice and the whole apples. One of the key factors involved is the abundant amount of fiber in whole foods like unprocessed apples. Fiber, especially soluble fiber like pectin and gum, slows the emptying of foods from the stomach and helps to slow the absorption of simple sugars by the small intestine. Some of the most profound research on diet, the frontal lobe, and depression points the finger at other popular American food items that are high in fat and protein. Diets that emphasize such high fat protein choices tend to run a life cycle of popularity. Most readers have likely heard of regimens like the Atkins diet, the Zone diet, or other similar eating regimens that avoid carbohydrates. When enough people experience the downsides of such programs, these diets inevitably fall out of favor. Then, a new generation comes along and again embraces the same program that, incidentally, often do lead to some initial weight loss. High carbohydrate intake increases serotonin and reduces cortisol. The problem with diets that skimp on carbohydrates is that they compromise frontal lobe functioning. It is now well established that one way to improve brain levels of mood-elevating serotonin is to boost your carbohydrate intake. Many patients have learned to adopt a carbohydrate diet in order to gain an emotional lift. On a low-protein diet, liberal amounts of carbohydrates raise brain levels of tryptophan, a vital amino acid that is used by the brain to make serotonin. Short-term drops in the blood tryptophan levels can actually result in a relapse of depression. Low blood tryptophan states have demonstrated decreased function in a critical frontal lobe area, the orbitofrontal cortex, that is associated with depression. Ironically, over the long haul, a low-carbohydrate diet may not only predispose to depression, but to weight gain. The first links in this chain come from fascinating studies conducted in the Netherlands under the direction of Dr. C.R. Marcus. These European researchers demonstrated that individuals who have a stress-related worsening of depressive symptoms do remarkably better if they are given a low-protein, high-carbohydrate diet. Their research lends support to the fact that stress-prone individuals are at greater risk of brain serotonin deficiency and that carbohydrates may prevent a shortage of serotonin due to stressful situations. Also of interest is their finding that a carbohydrate-rich diet not only blocked a stress-induced rise in depression, but also prevented a rise in cortisol. In contrast, those very same individuals experienced heightened depression scores and cortisol increases if they were eating a protein-rich, low-carbohydrate diet before exposure to stress. The remaining links in the chain associating high-protein, high-fat diets to long-term risk of weight gain comes from researchers at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Appel and colleagues reported a connection between stress-related rises in cortisol and increased food consumption. The picture that emerges shows that avoiding carbohydrates may be particularly harmful for people prone to stress-related overeating. On a low-carbohydrate diet, such individuals are at greater risk not only for increased depressive tendencies, but also for rises in cortisol levels that are associated with increased food consumption. The message I take away from this research is that adults as well as school children need a high-carbohydrate diet if they want to function at peak mental efficiency and decrease their risk of depression and counterproductive stress-related responses. Now that we've established the benefits of a high-carbohydrate, low-protein diet in combating depression and increasing the general performance of our brain, it begs a question. What food should we eat to get these benefits? What changes in our diet do we need to gain these advantages? The answer to these vital questions is very simple. A liberal supply of fruits, vegetables, and grains, all unrefined, provide the best nourishment for the frontal lobe. All these foods contain a healthy quantity of carbohydrates and are packed with nutrients, including fiber, and sugar in its unrefined form. Meat is devoid of carbohydrates. Meat is essentially devoid of carbohydrates. If you look at food tables, you will see a recurring theme. Whether it's red meat, fish, or chicken, they all score a big zero, or very close to it, in the carbohydrate category. This may be one reason why meat is associated with subtle frontal lobe impairment. I recommend beginning each day with a high-quality breakfast that includes a balanced selection of plant foods. My family typically chooses a variety of fruits and whole grains along with a few nuts or a nut butter. These items keep the blood sugar in the proper range throughout the entire morning without a need for a snack. There is another bit of irony in all this data. Because the brain is very adaptable and becomes accustomed to your lifestyle, even healthy changes may cause a short-term decline in brain efficiency before any improvement occurs. It is comparable to the situation with the nicotine that I wrote about in Proof Positive. Despite nicotine's deleterious brain effects, when a person stops smoking, sleep quality and mental agility tend to worsen before they get better. The same is true with diet. Research suggests that when people dramatically change their diet, like increasing their intake of fat or even carbohydrates, mental performance can suffer in the short term. However, persevering with a better lifestyle will bring benefits in time. The message is, no matter how difficult it may be in the short term, develop new, healthy habits and stick with them. A Spartan diet can improve brain performance. For years, researchers have known that animals live longer if they are calorically deprived, given less to eat than they would normally choose. An American research team under the direction of Dr. L.W. Means added new evidence for the benefits of a Spartan diet. Means and his colleagues, by direct measurement, showed improved brain performance on a lower-calorie diet. Furthermore, their research demonstrated that animals received these brain benefits even if they did not begin such a restricted diet until they were middle-aged. This is not isolated research. Researchers from Italy first demonstrated the obvious. Rats on a normal diet lose mental function as they age. The investigators went on to discover that old rats that had been on a low-calorie diet since birth had mental abilities as good as their younger counterparts. The performance of our brains today can be affected by the number of calories we consumed 15 years ago. 99 subjects aged 75 or older were tested in California for mental performance by taking the Mini-Mental State Examination. Those who consumed more calories in 1976 had lower test scores in 1991. This study indicates that a higher consumption of calories in middle age accelerates the decline of mental function with aging. These studies suggest that overeating, also referred to as intemperate eating, can impair the whole brain. Such global mental decline would be expected to also compromise the frontal lobe. When we think of the effect of a properly nourished frontal lobe on the potential for a fuller, richer life, it is encouraging. We do not have to be a statistic of poor mental health. We all have the opportunity to enjoy a high quality of life with longevity as a bonus. Nutrition and lifestyle deserve our most serious efforts. The results will be felt day by day and year by year. Music depression and the frontal lobe. Music appears to have both general and specific brain effects. Listening to music, regardless of the type of music, appears to favorably balance frontal lobe function in depression. By actual EEG measurement, music decreases over-dominant right frontal lobe activity in chronically depressed individuals. However, medical research also raises serious concerns about certain types of music. Few people understand music's powerful frontal lobe influence. All music enters the brain through its emotional regions, yet some types of music also stimulate frontal lobe responses. Thus, depending on the type of music, its net influence can be either beneficial or detrimental, depending on whether it predominantly stimulates the frontal lobe or the lower emotional centers. Music therapists tell us certain types of music, such as rock with its syncopated rhythm, bypass the frontal lobe and our ability to reason and make judgments about it. Evidence suggests that it, like television, can produce hypnotic effect. Over the years, various individuals have accused rock music of ruining America's youth. Some years ago, researchers Schreckenberg and Bird, a neurobiologist and physicist, teamed up to put this generalization to a test. They designed a study to evaluate neurological reactions in mice to different music rhythms. Throughout their 8-week study, the investigators kept their mice divided into 3 groups. One group constantly heard rock-like, disharmonic drum beats softly played. A second group heard only classical music, while a third heard no music at all. At the beginning of the study, all the mice went through a standardized maze test, searching for food at the end of the maze. All 3 groups performed equally well, groping about the maze until they found the food. By the end of the 8 weeks, the second and third groups had learned the direct path to the food. The rock group, however, was still groping about, taking much longer to find the food than the other 2 groups. Next, there was a 3-week break in their maze training where no music was played. After that, the mice were retested. Again, the rock group performed poorly. They continued to have difficulty remembering how to get to their food, while the other 2 groups still found it quickly. The rock group seemed almost to be starting from scratch, groping around disorientedly. Both the control group and the classical group, on the other hand, could run the maze considerably faster, proving they retained what they learned. However, the rock group appeared to have an irreversible learning handicap. To determine why the poor performers had so much trouble, the researchers examined their brains, looking for changes in the hippocampus. Remember, this region lies deep in the brain and affects emotions, memory, and learning. Schreckenberg and Bird found visible evidence of abnormal branching and sprouting of nerve cells, as well as disruptions in messenger RNA, a chemical crucial to memory storage. The researchers concluded that music rhythms, not harmonic or melodic structure, cause the memory and learning problems. They theorized that certain musical rhythms help synchronize natural biological rhythms and enhance body functions, while other rhythms tend to clash with or disrupt internal rhythms. When natural rhythms are disrupted, detrimental effects result, including permanent learning difficulties. Schreckenberg and Bird's research not only linked rock-like music to hippocampal damage, they also found it caused frontal lobe shrinkage. If such results carried over to humans, we would expect deleterious effects on moral values, learning, and reasoning power. Furthermore, because of the connections between frontal lobe impairment and depression, we might also anticipate a connection between rock music and depression. Although neurologists, psychologists, and other health professionals may debate some of the connections between music genres and depression, several associations seem clear from the human research literature. First, rock music and music videos have been linked to harmful beliefs and behaviors even in adolescence, such as harmful sexual attitudes and alcohol use. Furthermore, music videos, especially those shown on MTV, have a track record of positively modeling tobacco smoking. Indeed, a variety of risky behaviors have been associated with watching contemporary music videos and heavy metal music preferences. Second, such high-risk behaviors, whether they involve substance abuse, sexual attitudes and practices, or other behaviors, in and of themselves are associated with depression. See Chapter 3. Third, if someone becomes frankly depressed and is contemplating suicide, music videos with violent and self-destructive imagery appear to nurture suicidal thinking. A number of studies have described a link between heavy metal listening and suicidal ideation. Although research suggests pre-existing factors may attract youth with suicidal tendencies to this music genre, there are also indications that such rock music perpetuates depression and suicidal ideation. On the other hand, harmonious hymns and symphonies produce beneficial frontal lobe responses. Although controversial, the research literature has been convincing enough to me that I raised my children in this kind of musical environment. For example, some studies link classical music, such as Mozart's piano sonatas, to improved spatial-temporal reasoning, useful in disciplines like engineering and geometry. In another study, 3 to 5-year-old children were given 8 months of group singing and keyboard lessons, demonstrating improved frontal lobe function compared with similar-aged children who didn't receive such music lessons. The impact of music on shaping the character, and hence the frontal lobe, was recognized at least 23 centuries ago. Aristotle, the famous Greek philosopher, wrote, quote, "When one listens to music that imitates a certain passion, he becomes imbued with the same passion. If over a long time he habitually listens to the kind of music that rouses ignoble, degraded or vulgar, passions, his whole character will be shaped to an ignoble form. In short, if one listens to the wrong kind of music, he will become the wrong kind of person. Conversely, if he listens to the right kind of music, he will tend to become the right kind of person." Unquote. Aristotle thus unwittingly referred to the frontal lobe, the seat of our character. Certainly, from the studies we briefly reviewed, most music television programming and other sources of rock-like music appear to fit into Aristotle's category of music that shapes character to an ignoble form. I can't help but wonder what would happen if our young people all grew up in a positive, supportive environment with the best quality classical music. I would imagine that many more would become wholesome, ethical individuals who would be numbered among the greatest men and women in history. Studies show that prayer improves health. Even honest skeptics are being forced to conclude that prayer has unique benefits that Eastern meditation cannot provide. A case in point is provided by Dr. Larry Dosse, an internal medicine specialist trained at the prestigious Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. Dr. Dosse was raised in the evangelical Protestant tradition of the Bible Belt. He became a self-proclaimed agnostic while in college. Some years later, he became interested in Eastern philosophies like Buddhism and Taoism and began to practice meditation. His spiritual perspective was shattered when he found that there's a host of scientific studies showing that prayer for patients could actually improve their health. As Dosse described his initial reaction to the compelling data, he wanted nothing to do with, quote, talking to God, unquote. Ultimately, he came to the opposite conclusion. quote, I decided that not to employ prayer with my patients was the equivalent of withholding a potent drug or surgical procedure, unquote. Dossé, convinced by the power of prayer, was no longer content to meditate in the Eastern fashion. He made it a daily practice to commune with the absolute source of power. Dossé's experience does not address the effect of prayer on the frontal lobe. However, it does demonstrate that from the perspective of thinking scientists, prayer has benefits that extend beyond mere meditation. Dossé does, however, make profound connections between prayer and the frontal lobe in his book, Healing Wounds, The Power of Prayer, and the Practice of Medicine. The theme of the book is remarkable because Dossé is not a religious zealot who is trying to promote a particular sect. He comes across as an honest scientist who was forced to acknowledge the power of prayer despite his preconceived biases. Although my understanding of prayer differs from Dossé's, I believe he has pulled together some valuable insights that are relevant to this chapter. One of the interesting frontal lobe connections is brought to light when Dossé links prayer with one of the most baffling occurrences of secular physicians, the spontaneous regression of cancer. In spontaneous regression of cancer, a person with a fatal cancer survives without undergoing any treatment. The individual may actually be cured and totally free of cancer, or there may still be evidence of the cancer's presence without it taking any toll on the person. Dossé quotes the research of Yujiro Ikemi in Japan on cancer regression and makes the following observation. Quote, often a prayerful, prayer-like attitude of devotion and acceptance, not robust aggressive prayer for specific outcomes, including eradication of the cancer, precedes the cure, unquote. Interestingly, it may be the frontal lobe's connection with God through prayer and a resulting acceptance of ill health or adversity that helps to pave the way for healing. Later in his book, when Dossé again discusses Ikemi's research, he points out that, quote, all the patients who experienced spontaneous regeneration from cancer gave themselves totally to the will of God after learning they had cancer, unquote. There is evidence that typical meditation or relaxation training can short-circuit this process and be detrimental. A study of stress hormones in surgery patients before, immediately following, and 2 days after surgery seemed to support these contentions. Dossé points out that British researchers found the immune-weakening stress hormones significantly increased only in those who had frontal relaxation training. Those who addressed their anxieties and fears without using relaxation techniques did not show the rise in stress hormones. Prayer's focus is not on denial or dealing with symptoms, but to bring the praying person in touch with God. Prayer at times can be primarily receptive, consenting to God's will. At other times, prayer can be extremely active. Examples include struggling with God for answers to difficult questions or seeking to know His will in a perplexing situation. In this latter context, prayer can be viewed as one of the ultimate frontal lobe activities. It could be argued that without a frontal lobe that is sound and intact, we cannot optimally pray such active, focused prayers. Defying your moral code is dangerous. Since the frontal lobe is the seat of morality, habitually going against your moral code may cause frontal lobe suppression, quieting the voice of conscience and possibly making you feel better for the short term. Consider the story of Elijah, a prophet of God. Even the most faithful prophets of God were not immune to depression. Elijah had spent what must have been the most exhilarating day of his life on Mount Carmel, leading out in a contest between the God of Israel and the God of Baal. There he watched as the prophets of Baal spent most of the day wildly exhorting their lifeless god to accept their sacrifice by sending fire to consume it. After Baal failed to answer their noisy rituals, Elijah quietly knelt before his offering and spoke a short, simple prayer that God answered immediately with a majestic display of fire from heaven. It consumed his offering and even the altar on which it was held. He then prayed for God to end the years of drought that had plagued the land. God answered his persistent prayer that evening, and Elijah ran in front of King Ahab's chariot in a downpour, leading him a great distance through the dark back to the safety of the palace. How much greater evidence of God's power and presence could Elijah have experienced, and all in one day? But that night, he received a warning that Jezebel was out to kill him. Elijah apparently forgot about God's mighty power and how he had just been protected from 450 priests of Baal and the king of Israel. He panicked at the threat of a heathen woman. After the exhausting day he had just experienced, he jumped up and ran a day's journey into the wilderness, collapsed under a juniper tree, and cried for the Lord to take his life. It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am not better than my father's. At this point, God sent an angel to feed Elijah. An angel? How much more clearly could God's favor be expressed? Yet, Elijah continued his flight for more than a month until he came to a cave where he settled down in a mood of despair. God asked him what he was doing there, and Elijah answered, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with a sword. And I, even I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Elijah had allowed his mind to be controlled by despondency, which in turn disheartened him to the point of losing his faith and trust in the God who had so majestically revealed his presence. Instead of standing firm for God against a human queen, Elijah's mind was captivated by negative thoughts he allowed to take hold. God had planned for Elijah to lead a great revival in Israel. Instead, Elijah went against God's will and gave in to depression. Have you ever gone against God's will for your life? Are you doing it now? Can you take the chance of having the seat of your morality compromised by rebellion against what you know to be right? Can you take the chance of having to make daily choices with a brain that is no longer in communion with God? Your frontal lobe is your connection to God's network. Keep it connected by doing His will. The frontal lobe, making it practical. In this chapter, I presented in my judgment much vital and useful information about the frontal lobe. It deserves a summary list of insights to help us protect and enhance the function of the crown of the brain. Number one, protect your frontal lobe from physical injury. Physical injury can inflict permanent brain damage. Boxing, football, and motorcycle riding are examples of high-risk activities. Blows to the head while boxing frequently damage the tiny blood vessels, particularly in the frontal lobe. A boxer with these injuries is sometimes referred to as being punch drunk. Other sports can lead to similar injuries. All such activities are best avoided by those who want to maintain good frontal lobe function. Frontal lobe injury by physical means is not limited to sports participants. Head injuries from automobile collisions can inflict frontal lobe damage. For this reason, car seat belts and shoulder harnesses are a must. Furthermore, workplace injuries are not confined to the Phineas Gages of yesteryear. Take all reasonable safety precautions on the job. Number two, prevent diseases that may damage your frontal lobe. The proper use of preventative medicine principles can also help you preserve frontal lobe function. A number of diseases can lead to loss of frontal lobe capacity. Many of these maladies are preventable. Stroke is among the most worrisome. Happily, controlling risk factors such as high blood pressure can often prevent it. Independent risk factors for stroke in people between the ages of 16 and 60 include high blood pressure, diabetes, current tobacco use, heart disease, and alcohol consumption within 24 hours preceding the onset of the stroke. Women can add oral contraceptives to this stroke risk factor list. High blood pressure and strokes are not the only condition that can jeopardize the frontal lobe. Physical conditions often affect brain performance. Heart conditions can lead to problems that later affect the brain. Nervous system disorders of many sorts compromise brain function. In fact, being ill with any serious disease will have measurable effects on the brain. The bottom line is to follow a healthful lifestyle that addresses your body's total needs. Number three, avoid drugs and toxins that can impair brain performance. In addressing causes of frontal lobe dysfunction, I must reemphasize the association made with drugs and toxins. Clearly, if we want to give ourselves the best advantage to prevent and/or treat depression, as well as to enhance frontal lobe function in general, we will avoid all mind-altering drugs. That list includes legal drugs, like caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol, as well as street drugs. Number four, improve the quality of your brain's blood supply. Enhancing the quality of the brain's blood supply is important. Again, this improvement stands to help the entire brain, not just the frontal lobe. What can you do? Breathe clean, fresh, well-oxygenated air. In Proof Positive, I review the body of research suggesting that negatively charged ions in fresh air enhance mental performance. In addition to the quality of air, our habits of breathing may also make a difference. In a classroom or office setting, most of us do not realize that we tend to take shallow breaths. This may be one reason we may find it somewhat more difficult to concentrate after 30 minutes. Shallow breathing has the deleterious effects of allowing our blood oxygen levels, called oxygen saturation, to dip below the level necessary for optimal frontal lobe performance. Consciously taking deep breaths periodically may help to counter this tendency. By taking deep breaths, particularly of fresh air, we may be able to boost oxygen saturation sufficiently to improve frontal lobe function. In addition to taking deep breaths while sitting, regular aerobic exercise, preferably outdoors, will cause the heart to pump vital oxygenated blood to the brain. Number 5, good nutrition. I've focused a significant portion of this chapter on the role of good nutrition in optimal frontal lobe function. An abundance of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and nuts, while avoiding meat and cheese, is the best diet to improve the ability of our front brains. Nursing infants should be breastfed. Number 6, get adequate sunshine. Sunlight has beneficial effects on the mood in general, and the frontal lobe in particular. Among other things, sunshine is capable of increasing serotonin production in the daytime. This in turn helps prevent depression and fatigue. Animal research further indicates that exposure to natural daylight results in significantly higher evening melatonin levels than an equal amount of exposure to artificial light. The role of melatonin, in turn, promotes sound sleep and may help to boost frontal lobe function the following day. Of further relevance, an autopsy series of suicidal victims found significantly less melatonin in their brains than in the brains of others who died at the same age and the same time of day. Some of the relationship with suicide may be explained by the loss of the effect of melatonin in relieving stress. The work of Georges Maestroni and his Swiss collaborators provide evidence that melatonin plays a role in decreasing the impact of stress on the body. Number 7, exercise both your body and your mind. We discussed the importance of physical exercise to both improve and balance brain function. Physical exercise is a neglected strategy for mental health and depression treatment. Also, mental exercise is very important. Just as our muscles shrivel if we do not use them, so it is with our frontal lobe. The challenge of mental tasks will help maintain our mental acuity by stimulating the frontal lobe. Serious reading, the study of nature, asking questions about the vast world surrounding us, and other wholesome uses of our mental capacities tends to stimulate the frontal lobe. One recent study found that imagining a certain activity stimulated 80% of the brain circuitry that would be used to physically perform the very task imagined. Such mental practice strengthens the brain-cell connections, and when the time comes to execute the activity, the individual is better prepared. Mental activity in children and teenagers is especially important in enhancing the ability to learn. Scientists have now discovered the first strong evidence that intellectual stimulation can significantly increase the number of brain cells in a crucial region of the brain. Previously, it was thought that the number of active brain cells was more or less set in early childhood. This landmark study was performed at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. There, young mice were provided with an enriched environment, with more games and toys, and room to roam in extra-large cages. When the results were in, those mice had developed 15% more brain cells in a key part of the brain responsible for memory and learning than genetically identical mice living in sparse surroundings. The extra brain cells enable them to negotiate complex mazes faster and more efficiently. Researchers say that there is every reason to suppose that similar results would hold true for humans. The important conclusion is that the environment we provide for our children and teenagers may actually influence their number of brain cells and their ability to learn. Ellen White describes the effects of challenging the brain in the following quote. Quote, "The understanding adapts itself to the dimensions of the subjects with which it is required to deal. If occupied with trivial, commonplace matters only, never summoning to earnest effort to comprehend great and eternal truths, it becomes dwarfed and enfeebled. Hence, the value of the scriptures as a means of intellectual culture." Unquote. Control what we see, hear, and experience. The final point on the list is related to the previous point. Dwelling on happy, positive themes and exposing our minds to great inspirational material aids in combating depression as well as enlarging our minds and strengthening our intellects. And do not forget the frontal lobe balancing effects of a good massage. Massage therapy's growth in popularity has ensured access to quality professionals in most areas of our country. Negatively, many sensory inputs have the ability to compromise our frontal brain function. This is true whether we consciously give someone permission to bypass our frontal lobe, as in hypnosis, or unconsciously compromise our frontal lobe function and balance through activities like watching entertainment television or listening to rock music. Since spirituality, morality, and the will are centered in the frontal lobe of the brain, the optimal choice for input seems to be inspirational material chosen to appeal to our spiritual and moral natures. In my experience, the study of the Word of God fills this requirement like no other can. Ellen White outlined the impact of studying the Scriptures on the mind, soul, and intellect in the following quotes. Quote, "The Bible, just as it reads, is to be your guide. Nothing is so calculated to enlarge the mind and strengthen the intellect as the study of the Bible. No other study will so elevate the soul and give vigor to the faculties as the study of the living oracles. As the mind is brought to the study of God's Word, the understanding will enlarge, and the higher power will develop for the comprehension of high and ennobling truths." Unquote. I've used considerable space in this chapter, making the point that proper physical and mental habits are important for optimal frontal lobe function. Clearly, right mental habits promote mental excellence. At the same time, right physical habits promote mental superiority. These are the laws of nature, laws that the Creator has put into our being. Quote, "Intellectual power, physical strength, and longevity depend upon immutable laws. There is no happenstance, no chance, about this matter. Heaven will not interfere to preserve men from the consequences of the violation of nature's laws." Unquote. In conclusion, God has provided each of us with the power to freely choose how we will live, and He usually does not interfere even when we make bad choices. Truly, there is much truth in the adage that every person is the architecture of his own fortune. In view of this tremendous power that you have been given to shape your own future, please take some time today to look seriously at your lifestyle. I challenge you to reflect on your current health habits and ask yourself if you can take what you've learned from this chapter and improve them. Identify some concrete steps that you will take within the next week to help protect and enhance your frontal lobe and, with it, your entire body. A healthful lifestyle makes sense. Do not merely follow your old ways of doing things just because they are comfortable or because everyone else is doing it. In the words of Scripture, quote, "Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God."
You've been listening to Depression: The Way Out by Dr. Neil Nedley. Copyright 2014. To purchase this or other books by Dr. Nedley, or to learn more about their 10-day residential or their 8-week community programs, visit www.nedleyhealthsolutions.com.